I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. Space Shuttle Atlantis is scheduled to launch July 8th for the last time, concluding NASA's 30-year shuttle program. The shuttle has made a reality out of what used to be science fiction: astronauts orbiting the Earth, nations working collaboratively on an international space station. This week on Intersection, it's a behind-the-scenes tour of the Kennedy Space Center and the shuttle program. Plus, Central Florida is home to the world's largest cluster of simulation, modeling, and training companies specializing in defense. Now that the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are winding down, what's next for the industry? We'll talk with Tom Baptiste, president and director of the Orlando-based National Center for Simulation. Those conversations and stories ahead on Intersection. Reporters from 90.7 have been heading out to the Space Coast on a variety of assignments as the shuttle program winds down. Intersection has gone to the Kennedy Space Center for some tapings, and I've been out to report on launches, landings, and to look behind the scenes of the shuttle program. After Space Shuttle Endeavour landed earlier this month, reporters went to view Space Shuttle Atlantis for a sunrise viewing at the launch pad as it's being prepped for the last mission of the shuttle program.
It's an early morning out at the Kennedy Space Center at Pad 39A. The press have all gathered to see Atlantis on the pad before she launches on July 8th. This is the final rollout for Space Shuttle Atlantis. We've got helicopters and press all hovering around looking at the shuttle. It really does look fantastic out on the launch pad. It's much bigger than you think it would be, even at the distance that we're standing, which is got to be about half a mile away at this point. It really is fantastic just to see the space shuttle out here at the launch pad, Space Shuttle Atlantis, getting ready to fly on the final mission of the shuttle program.
Now keep in mind, at this point, I was up for 30 hours, having covered the 2:30 in the morning landing of Space Shuttle Endeavour. And it's at this kind of moment that there's not much filter on the brain.
I will say that the biting gnats are not a particularly pleasant aspect of the sunrise.
There was just one more sound from the launch pad before leaving. It started suddenly. It ended just as quickly. I'm still trying to find out from NASA what that was. Before the rollout could even happen, technicians had to assemble the different components of the shuttle in the vehicle assembly building. I got to visit Atlantis while it was still inside the VAB. And one thing that's surprising about seeing the shuttle as it gets ready for launch or has just returned from orbit is just how little of the shuttle you actually get to see. Inside the cavernous vehicle assembly building, the shuttle is attached to its solid rocket boosters and big orange external fuel tank. And unless the shuttle is moving inside the building, it's usually obscured by catwalks that wrap around it. I could barely see the top of the nose and the bottom of the tail sticking out, but what I did notice was the howling wind that moves through the top of the 52-story building. In a hangar next to the vehicle assembly building sits Space Shuttle Discovery. It's already flown its final mission, and workers are preparing it for display at the Smithsonian. I got the rare opportunity to go inside the shuttle. Again, it's surrounded by catwalks, and you have to climb a lot of stairs to get to it. After climbing up a few levels, I arrived at the nose of Discovery. A big chunk of it is missing. That's where the maneuvering jets that move the shuttle while it's in orbit have been taken out. And then we went into the white room. It's where technicians check over you to make sure there's nothing loose, like jewelry or something that can damage the shuttle.
All the reporters have to put on these very stylish white and red booties.
And then you slide in through a little hole in the side of the spacecraft, and a small ladder leads you to the flight deck.
So we're actually inside the cockpit of Space Shuttle Discovery, and you look at this and you think, my gosh, they must be in a spaceship. But really, the spaces are incredibly small. The space between the legroom of the pilots is smaller, I think, than what you have on a commercial airliner here. And, of course, you can't see out the cockpit windows. They're covered up. But you see all the gauges and the dials. They've got those classic NASA dials that have certain switches so you know for sure what you're hitting. Don't accidentally hit a wrong button. But you can also look out the back into the cargo bay hold, and you can see the joystick that allows you to control the boom arm and so on. And that is really cool. And you can imagine what it must be like to be in orbit in the shuttle looking out into outer space.
On the way out of the hangar, I was able to catch up with Stephanie Stilson from NASA. She's the flow director for the shuttles as they transition from flight to display. I asked her about the mood of the workforce as they get the space shuttles ready for retirement.
The mood of the workforce is up and down. It's definitely not always real enthusiastic in the sense that some folks are going to have to leave and they're not ready to leave. So that's a very hard time. I've never had to go through anything like that. And it's hard to see people that you consider to be not just your friends, but in some cases family members, because you spend so much time together, not being able to be a part of everything until the very end for each of these vehicles. But they're being very professional. They understand the changes that are going on. They are staying focused on the job at hand. So I've been very impressed by the entire workforce and how they're handling this.
That's NASA's Stephanie Stilson talking with me about getting the space shuttles and the group of people that maintain them both ready for retirement. 90.7 will have special coverage leading up to the final launch of the shuttle all next week. And if you know what our mystery noise is back at the launch pad with Space Shuttle Atlantis, drop us a line at intersection@WMFE.org or on the WMFE Facebook and Twitter pages. And don't forget, you can look at our Facebook album of shots of the space shuttle we've been collecting over the past few weeks. Up next, the defense industry and simulation here in Central Florida. Everyone knows that tourism is a big industry in Florida, and if you focus on Orlando and Central Florida, tourism looms even larger. But one thing a lot of people don't know is that Central Florida is home to the largest cluster of companies that work on modeling and simulation for the Defense Department in the nation. The U.S. military is involved around the globe, running two major wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. As those conflicts wind down, though, is there going to be a reduction in the amount of demand for military simulation? And what's that going to mean for Central Florida? Well, here to talk about it is Tom Baptiste. He is a retired Air Force Lieutenant General and currently heads the National Center for Simulation located in Orlando. Tom, welcome to Intersection.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
So I think a lot of people hear the word simulation, and it's not really clear what that means for us here in Central Florida. What are some of the things that you work on at the Center for Simulation?
Well, I represent, as a trade association, I represent 168 member companies, and the companies are the ones that build the simulation device and develop the technology that we provide primarily to the Department of Defense. So I think most people are familiar with flight simulators. Some have probably flown a Microsoft flight simulator on their desktop. Well, that's what the companies do. They build devices, but they also build training programs and different types of technology that allows us to provide world-class training to the warfighters that are involved in those two wars that you mentioned.
Now, you say the flight simulator, and of course, you think on your desktop, that's just a little thing on a computer screen. But you guys go beyond just the thing on the computer screen, right? It's immersive, too.
Certainly. The full-up flight simulator is it's a mock-up of the airplane, so it will look the device itself will look exactly like the cockpit of an airplane. It will have a very sophisticated visual display that will wrap around at least 180 degrees and in some cases more than that. It will be, you can put a simulator anywhere in the world and actually have a ground display that looks realistic. So you can employ weapons, you can practice things that you will do in the real airplane. But the simulation has evolved over the last 45 years to become so good that most people who fly high-speed fighters like I did don't do anything in the airplane that they don't first experience in the simulator. So you do the routine kinds of training in the sim, and then you maximize the amount of time you have in the actual fighter.
For the simulation industry in Central Florida, you know, when you mention a flight simulator, that's people practicing how to use a specific piece of equipment, a specific machine, that airplane. And so I wondered, you know, where does the simulation industry go beyond just simulating those types of equipment training?
Well, I think one of the most exciting things that I see is that and just a little bit of background is probably appropriate, but the gaming industry, the games that the kids play, today, video games, spun off originally from the modeling, simulation, and training industry. But it has now developed into its own very high-tech and very capable sector of our economy, and it's huge. I mean, gaming industry is a big part of our economy. Well, it has become so powerful that it now feeds back new technology, such as virtual worlds, avatar technology, very sophisticated 3D displays that you see on kids' video games. Well, those types of technologies are now feeding back into the types of training devices and technologies that we're developing for our warfighters to immerse them in a virtual world, in a realistic environment that emulates what they will see on the battlefield of today, either in Iraq or Afghanistan. And so it's not just about flight simulators or tank driver simulators or ship driver simulators and those kinds of things. We are developing sophisticated, virtual, immersive kinds of environments where, using a virtual world, you can put a soldier, sailor, airman, or marine in a realistic environment and give them a glimpse at what they will see when they get to the battle theater.
And it shows that there's an improvement in the way training is conducted and the actual experience on the battlefield because of those simulations?
Oh, absolutely. I think probably the biggest example or best example I can give you is that out at 29 Palms, our Marine Corps has built a simulated city, a Middle Eastern city, that is the size of San Diego.
This is in California, right?
In California, yeah. 29 Palms is a Marine Corps facility. But at that, what they've done, they've invited Hollywood and role players to come in and make that environment so real that the soldiers will be, or the Marines in this case, will be immersed in an Iraqi or an Afghani village and have to do the sorts of things that they will do when they get to Iraq or Afghanistan. The role players emulate the local population. They have engagement problems where they can't communicate. They will have to do their best. They will have to make decisions on life, you know, life-threatening decisions on whether they someone is a threat or not and whether they're going to employ their weapons. But they are immersed in a city that is so very real that the feedback we get from the troops when they come back from Afghanistan and Iraq is said they've never had training any better than what they received at 29 Palms in preparation for their tour overseas.
Now, does that kind of training also happen here in Central Florida?
There is a place called Camp Blanding up toward between here and Jacksonville, which is a military operations and urban terrain center of excellence. I know that's kind of alphabet soup, but it is the same sort of environment that they have produced at 29 Palms, where they will take small units and immerse them in a training situation with realistic types of buildings and allow them to practice small unit tactics in an environment that is very much the same as they will see when they go overseas.
So how does that connect then back to Orlando?
Well, a number of the scenarios, the role-playing, the devices that will track the movement of soldiers so that they can then, during an after-action review exactly where you were at any point in time during the scenario and basically recreate in a debriefing, if you will, what happened so that they're, most of the learning happens after the event. So it's not that they're not learning when they're immersed in the environment, but so much is happening that they can't absorb it all. When you take that away and go to an after-action review and actually replay the scenario and look where everybody was, the real learning outcomes happen then. And that's when soldiers and sailors, airmen and Marines really get value from their training.
Well, Tom, talk to me a little bit about why Central Florida. How did this simulation industry end up being here of all places?
Very interesting. And I'm sorry, but I'll have to give you some background here because we have to go back 45 years. 45 years ago, in 1965, a small unit of Army and Navy simulation experts moved from Long Island, New York, to the training and equipment base that was located in what is now Baldwin Park. It used to be a naval training facility there. They set up shop, and they operated there from 1965 until, I believe, around 1988. At that point in time, there was a small little research park starting to emerge next to a growing university that we now call the University of Central Florida. And through the good efforts of Senator Bill Nelson, he convinced the Navy to move that little detachment of simulationists out to what has become the Research Park, which is the seventh largest research park in America. So that was the beginnings, the seed corn of what has grown into a $5 billion per year industry. The other services recognized that something special was happening in Orlando. This research park was starting to grow. UCF was becoming much bigger and has now grown to be the second largest university in America. So it's the proximity and the collaboration and cooperation that is facilitated by the research park, which attracted the other services to put their acquisition commands here as well. So now what you have in the research park is you have all of the acquisition organizations for all of the military services except for the Air Force.
Now, you're an Air Force guy, so we're going to put you on the hot seat right here. How come the Air Force isn't here?
Well, you have to go back to the beginning of flight, and if you look at the heraldry associated with Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio, it's going to be very difficult to move the Air Force out of there. I mean, that was the beginning of flight. You know, the Wright brothers operated from there. They took their vehicle to the North Carolina to actually fly it. But, you know, you can go back to the beginnings of manned flight, and it surrounds Wright-Patterson. So the Air Force will stay there. But the Air Force is smart enough to know that they have to have a presence here, and they do through the Air Force Agency for Modeling and Simulation, which is located here in the Research Park. So they are plugged into what we refer to as Team Orlando, and they watch very carefully what goes on here because this is the epicenter of the modeling, simulation, and training industry.
So, Tom, I've heard a lot about medical simulation in Central Florida. Is the center involved in that sort of activity as well?
Well, for 60 years, the primary focus of what modeling and simulation and training industry companies have looked at is providing support to the Department of Defense, to our warfighters. But so much of what has been developed over years, the way I trained as a fighter pilot, you know, that paradigm could easily be applied to the training of future healthcare providers. And the technology is ready for tech transfer or spin-off into areas such as medical, transportation, homeland security, education, digital media, entertainment, and a number of other different applications. So with what is going on out at Lake Nona, our medical city, and the development there, I see a real window of opportunity for Central Florida to be a driver to integrate a simulation into the way we train our future healthcare providers. So the companies are ready. The healthcare system and the healthcare community needs to embrace in a bigger way the value of simulation and how you can use simulation as part of your curriculum to reduce training costs and to actually make the training better and more effective.
We know that the war in Iraq is winding down, the conflict in Afghanistan. Timelines are being talked about for withdrawal. So what does that mean for the simulation industry locally? And I don't know, does that start with what did the beginning of those conflicts mean for the simulation industry maybe in the end?
Well, there is a certain amount of the work that the companies that are involved in this industry do in direct support of requirements that are emerging within the theaters of Iraq and Afghanistan. But that is not a major portion of the work that
they
do.
It's not the bread and butter.
It's not. And when I look at the future and I listen to the budget battles on Capitol Hill, it's clear to me that defense is not going to be no different than any other sector of the government's budget. It's going to either stay flat or decline. Well, what does that mean for modeling, simulation, and training? Well, if you think about it for a second, if the top line of the defense budget stays level or declines, that means that the operation and maintenance accounts that each of the services own will have to decline, which means you can't fly airplanes, you can't steam ships, you can't drive tanks at the same rate you did before. So how is it that we will maintain the readiness of our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines? Well, simulation is part of the answer. So as you operate the real equipment less, you've got to fill the gap. And simulation is one way to sustain a certain level of readiness at a lower cost. It's more efficient, it's cheaper, and I think so what we'll see is that the trickle-down effect of a declining budget will not be as felt as hard in this industry as it might be in other major programs.
Does that also speak to the operating costs for the military going up and up as we see, you know, fuel costs rising and this sort of thing as well?
Well, and I would add to that not only just operating costs because of fuel and other things, but the fact that we have been engaged in two wars for a considerable amount of time, we are wearing out our real equipment at a rate that we can't sustain. So when you look at a declining budget, there's not going to be the luxury of replacing equipment that you've worn out in battle. So we're going to have to find a way to stand down our real weapon systems to reduce the wear and tear on those, and simulation is one way that you can fill the gap.
We're talking with Tom Baptiste. He's the head of the National Center for Simulation here in Orlando. You can tell us what do you think about the military's role right here in Central Florida. Tell us on the WMFE Facebook or Twitter pages. You can also contact us through the Florida Talks blog online at WMFE.org/intersection. You know, in late April, you were able to meet with Congresswoman Sandy Adams. And I wonder, you know, what's that conversation like when you've got a new member of Congress coming in? And, you know, is that a good conduit for you to have up on Capitol Hill? Tell us a little bit about that conversation.
Well, we followed that up with a breakfast event this week with or at the end of last week with Senator Bill Nelson. So and from my perspective, it's important as the head of the National Center for Simulation for me to engage and talk to our elected officials at every level. I'm talking about city, county, state, and federal, in order to inform them of the latest developments in modeling, simulation, and training, and to make sure that they can speak forcefully on behalf of this simulation cluster in Central Florida, especially during times like now when the budget battles are going on in Capitol Hill. So Sandy Adams was a longtime state representative. She has been in this area for a long time. She's very well aware of the modeling, simulation, and training industry, and she's a very, very strong advocate for promoting our business.
That's what we're talking about on the national stage. What about at the state level? Does the legislature have any role to play here in facilitating the simulation industry, or are there things you've got in the most recent legislative session or are hoping to get in future ones?
Well, I can't give you a specific example, but I think the role of that I look for from the state legislature is to create an environment that makes it attractive for business to come here and become part of this cluster. So it's the, you know, those kinds of incentives, those kinds of opportunities to be made available to companies that are thinking about relocating, and even more than that, to keep the companies that we have here today from leaving. We certainly, there's two parts of this. You would like to attract new companies to come to create new jobs, but you want to make sure that you keep the ones that are here now as well. So I think the state has a role to play in making the business climate here attractive to not only the companies that are here now, but those that are considering coming here.
In your opinion, is it an attractive environment to come to Central Florida?
Well, I think that's a work in progress and something that we always need to keep our eye on. Certainly, could it be better? Absolutely.
What would make it better?
Well, again, I don't want to. I'm not an expert on tax law. I'm not an expert on incentives that can be provided by development commissions and those kinds of things. So I like to stay away from trying to make up examples because I really, you know, I can't speak with that much clarity on it. But I will tell you that what we need to do, and this is just Tom Baptiste speaking now. I think we need to define, and we need to develop a label for Central Florida that is based upon not only our tourism industry, that this is a great place to come for entertainment, for tourism, but it's also a great place to come because there's significant high-tech opportunity here in modeling, simulation, and training, in photonics and optics, in alternative energy, in laser technology. There are many different high-tech clusters that are starting to emerge that we need to tell a better story about, that this is not just about coming for the entertainment that you find in Central Florida, but it's from business opportunity for high-tech industry.
So what's on the horizon for the simulation industry in Central Florida for the near term?
I think the most promising things that I see is the power of even the smallest device. And what I mean by that is something as small as an iPhone is so powerful today, it has more power than some of the mainframes that were originally designed in the early age of computers. And so what we're finding now is the smallest of devices have so much power that you can port training programs or academic programs to the smallest of device and provide an opportunity for e or distance learning that is available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, wherever someone has an internet connection. So not always relying on a fixed classroom with a fixed instructor gives us a lot more latitude in education and training today. I think the virtual worlds and avatar technology is opening up brand new, exciting ways that we can approach education and the training of our warfighters. So those are the emerging technologies that I think we will leverage to do things that we haven't even thought about today.
Clarify for me what you mean when you say avatar technology.
Well, I hope you've seen the movie Avatar.
I did. I saw that one.
But certainly what is happening is through the use of a virtual world, you can create a form or a figure, an avatar, that will emulate, for example, myself. So if let's say that you and I are not co-located but are doing the same sorts of things, let's say, in an Army unit. Well, through a virtual world, you and I could both join in on a training scenario that is driven completely in a virtual world. So you can sign in and you have your own avatar which represents you. And at the same time, right next to you is me. And the two of us are training and following a scenario and reacting to it and making our inputs and both gaining from the experience. But it's all done through an artificial being that's contained within the virtual world but that replicates you and I. So, I mean, I think that's kind of a way to describe it, but, probably not a real good way, not a technical way, but I think that's the best I can do.
And so I just wonder, I think for our listeners hearing all this, they think it sounds great, but where do they actually see the benefit in their day-to-day lives from the kind of work that gets done at the National Center for Simulation?
The benefit I think that the companies see is that, you know, in the past 12 months, we've probably have increased the awareness of this industry at every level, as I said, from state or from city to county to state and to the federal level. But across the entire Central Florida area, people just didn't know anything about this. And when you think about it, it's not just about the modeling, simulation, and training industry. This is a community. And what is good for the modeling, simulation, and training industry is good for our tourism. If we can attract a conference here and bring 5,000 people to come to a conference, that means they stay in our hotels. They drive on our highways. They pay the tolls. They buy things and they pay taxes on what they buy. So it generates revenue not just in support of the modeling, simulation, and training industry, but our entire community. And so I think awareness by the community that this exists means we can find better and more innovative ways to collaborate as a community and leverage this high-tech cluster.
Does it ever translate into a device that would be used in the everyday home or in the academic environment?
A device. Well, I think simulation touches your life every day. If you go to Disney World, that's simulation. If you go to Universal, it's all about simulation. It's all about storytelling. It's all about, and that's all part of simulation. It's not real. It's a fantasy world. But, you know, so I think more and more as we go forward, you will start to see simulation becoming a big part of your everyday life in many ways that we haven't even been able to define yet. So I think it's a promising future. It's we are the epicenter for the industry. We have a great resource here, a very, very important part of, like I say, a diversified Florida economy that's not just based on the agriculture, tourism, and home construction as it has been for the last several years.
Tom Baptiste is the director of the National Center for Simulation here in Orlando. Tom, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, absolutely.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at the Florida Talks blog. Visit WMFE.org/intersection to find out more. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Visit us at Facebook or Twitter, and if you go to the WMFE Facebook page, you can see photos from the Kennedy Space Center and the Space Shuttle on a recent visit. You can shoot email over to intersection@WMFE.org. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Amy Green is the assistant producer. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.